Welcome to the Cordwainers In Their Shoes podcast. My name is Katie Greenier and I'm Creative Talent and Network Director at Pentland Brands. Cordwainers are shoemakers, and today the worshipful company of Cordwainers looks to promote footwear design and entrepreneurship in both education and the fashion industry. To celebrate the company's 750th anniversary, we've brought back our podcast for season two to explore what it's like to walk in the shoes of those who have made them. So today I'm in Fulham and I have the honour of being with Michael James, Director of Sales and Development at Springline, England's only surviving shoe last maker. Michael is a craftsman and has worked with many of the best designers, brands and celebrities, measuring feet and making lasts for the rich and famous. Michael has been at Springline for 40 years. It's a long time. And we're about to find out why his craft is an endangered trade and how Springline has remained healthy when others have fallen. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Katie.
How are you getting on?
Yeah, good. Yeah. Arrived here. Got into Parsons Green on time.
It's very nice here, isn't it?
It's beautiful, isn't it?
I've never been here before.
I've never got off at Parsons Green. No, I haven't. No,
they look very Fulham, don't they, the people here?
Yeah, I was sat in the park, actually, for 10 minutes. Just people watching. It was quite nice, actually, because there was more people with shoes on than there were trainers, which was nice to see. And it's hot as well. So
a lot of boat shoes around here, I noticed.
I think I caught more students sitting out there. I saw quite a lot of Converse.
I definitely noticed.
Dr. Martin type.
I definitely noted they're a little bit more swankier than where I live.
Yeah, I don't know where you live, but they're definitely more swanky than Northampton. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So tell me, where did you grow up?
So I was born 1967 in Worthing. We moved up to Streatham when I was two, I think, and then on to Northampton when I was eight, which I think 1975. Yeah, just it really, I think, through work, through my parents' work.
And what did they do?
It was sort of, my dad was an architect and surveyor, so obviously there's a lot of building going on in Northampton. It'd been voted this sort of, they wanted to turn it into a new town, similar to sort of Milton Keynes. Mm-hmm. Which is a crying shame, really, because it's a beautiful old market town, really. So yeah, he came up for work. He was building supermarkets or measuring and doing his bit for supermarkets and buildings like that. So it was different. It was really different. I'd never had hay fever before. I got hay fever. In
Did you miss Streatham? How old were you then when you actually got there?
So I was eight. I was eight when I got to Northampton. A little bit, because obviously you're just getting into your schooling.
Just got your mates as well,
just getting your mates, yeah. We lived above, we had a family business called James Brothers. They were a building company, which I suppose is why my dad got into what he was doing. And we lived in the flat above this big old Victorian lump of a building. It was gates on the front with James Brothers across the yard over the road where they kept all the materials. So yeah, it was a bit different, you know, because we up to a 1970s housing estate, surrounded by cow fields and fields growing crops, you know, so it was completely different. Even at eight, you know, it felt a bit.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I do. I'm the youngest, so yeah. So my brother is the eldest, sister's the middle,
and you're the baby.
I'm the baby. Yes, yeah.
And so, how did you feel moving to Northampton then? What was it?
I mean, obviously 8 years old. So I met some friends quite quickly, settled in at school. It was fine. You know, just different, really. You could go out and play, whereas in London, even then in Streatham, I don't really remember playing in the streets. You could go over the fields to the building sites.
And were you good at school?
Terrible. No, I was okay. I was okay at the things I enjoyed. But yeah, my reports were always poor. Yeah, Michael should concentrate more. Easily led was a favourite. That was easily led.
And were you?
Yes, I think I was, really. Yeah, I think I was. I always ended up with the ones who were causing mischief in the class, really. So it's but yeah, it was good. I was fairly good at what I enjoyed, which really was art and sport.
Did you end up at, so what happened next? You left school.
Worked my way through, obviously, school, part got my O levels in art and English. Believe it or not, I can't believe I got English. I'm sure they mucked that up. And then before I left, I thought I was going to go to universities to do art. But a guy, so I went for my interview before I got my results, and he said, "Oh, you've got to have 3 O levels." So I only got 2. So I didn't actually go back. But I went for a chef's thing.
Yeah.
So I went to be a chef, but I couldn't afford the outfit. You had to buy the whites and the hat. So I couldn't afford that. All sorts of things I looked at doing, sort of, but didn't really, not in a big way. Sort of mucked about really all summer, playing tennis with some friends, and then I went on a YTS, which is sort of strange because just after I joined the YTS, the university rang up and said, "Well, just." No, you can. You're in. You can come. You know, you can come and do your art.
No,
but I'd sort of, you know, you sort of move on and So I'd moved on, really.
That boat had sailed away.
Yeah. So I sort of, YTS. Yeah, youth training scheme. So I'd done a bit of welding first on the YTS, which I hated, and then literally just looked down the list.
So for your YTS, did you have to go into the job centre and just go, right, these are the jobs that are on offer. I'm going to pick this. How did it work?
Yeah, it wasn't a job centre. I think it was a sort of connected to the school, really.
Oh, right.
I can't remember the actual. I remember it was on a place in Moulton Park.
Right.
But I can't remember what it was. But it was literally a list of different places you could go and learn trades. I had to get back on this YTS, really, because I just looked down the list and it had got Springline, if you're good with your hands, sort of thing. And I was like, okay, I'll have a go at that one then. Let's just have a little go at that.
So you went to Springline on a youth training scheme. And so what was your first role there? What did you do?
Just factory hand, really. You know, just things like putting levers on the top of last, because a lot of them were wood then, putting the thimbles in, the sockets. Just learning jobs in the factory.
I think what might be quite good is to perhaps explain to our listener what a last is.
Yeah, a lot of people
wouldn't know.
So a last, how I always explain it, is the internal shape of a shoe. So the insole is put on the last, the upper, the lever is pulled over the last, attached to the insole. I mean, obviously different constructions, but attached to the insole, and then the sole's stuck on. So it really forms the shape of your shoe. If you've got, for instance, if you've got a lady's 100mm heel height, so if you're wearing 3-inch heels, you're going to need a last that's 3 inches high with the toe shape of that shoe, you know, to form around.
So it is the most integral part to forming the shoe's form, and what it will actually look like at the end.
That's what I tell everybody.
Well, it is.
It's the start. You know, it's just a saying that the last is first, and really it should always be the start. When you're developing a shoe, you should always start with the last, and then it goes on to the heel or the sole or the platform.
So it's 1983, you were 16 and you were at Springline. What was that like?
Yeah, I didn't think I'd stay there. Obviously in the factory, it was dusty, it was dirty, full of old, I think the next youngest guy was about 40, and then the others were older. It was a funny place, really. It was probably about 12, 13 people working there.
How long did it take you to get into it?
Probably not that long, really. Probably 6 months, 8 months.
And what was the defining moment where you were like, actually, I like this?
I think the more jobs I learned, the more jobs you could just go in, get on with it, really. It was, you know, and you start feeling part of it. Then obviously, you know, for me, to be put into the model room and start learning how to model make. So, you know, and that really is, that's the bit that I think I was like, can I get this is good. It was, I suppose, did I ever think I'd stay there? It was, shoe trade was at the time, in a big decline. You know, there was big factories shutting monthly, you know, like the likes of British Shoe Corporation or what become Burlington's, Lambert Howarth, you know, all those big guys producing tens of thousands of pairs of shoes a week. They were going quickly because of, believe it or not, cheap imports. What was Italy when I started? So, you know, obviously now it's the Far East, Near East.
So how did you get yourself from the factory floor into the last room?
Yeah, I think just getting on with it, really. And then they said, "Do you want to try this in the model room, which is where all the development process is done?" And I was like, "Yeah, okay, let's have a go." You know, and then it was just a case of build up of jobs again, really.
So describe this. What is in the model room at this point in time? What does that look like?
Okay, a model room. So our model room now is it's got archives of Lars, wooden Lars. We always model in wood for Lars. So it's got an archive of.
Is there a specific wood?
There is, yeah. So we do our modelling in hornbeam, which is farmed. Obviously, all our woods are farmed now.
And is there a reason for hornbeam, or just that is traditional, or is there?
No, it was always Canadian maple, Katie. It was, but obviously it was not farmed.
Right.
I'm not even sure what year it was, but obviously at some point we had to stop using it because Canadian law said we had to stop using it, and we moved on to farm wood. So we now get it from Italy and France. It's 95% kiln dried. It's farmed. We use maple for shoe trees, beech for bespoke glass, hornbeam for modelling, and others. You know, there's others, lime, OBG, stuff like that.
So different wood for a different last.
Different, yeah. So bespoke. Yeah, bespoke makers like beech because it's easier to alter. Hornbeam's harder. So we like it because when we put it in the machines, it means it doesn't wear out as quickly. When bespoke workers, when we turn their last, they like it beech because it's easier to alter, really.
Amazing.
Yeah, so if they obviously do their first fit, so they get their client, they try it on, and if they have to tweak it, it's just softer to... Yeah.
So what is the difference between your current model room and the model room in 1983?
It's a lot bigger. It's a lot bigger. It was the one in 83 was almost like a hallway with a bench along the length of it. And we there's about three of us stood in a row there. So it's, now it's bigger. We've got some of the latest of the model archives up there. So we've got men's, ladies, children's, probably the last 2 years up there. We've got more kit up there. So there's saws in there, bandsaws and discs and things like that. And then, yeah, and there's four of us in there at the minute. So not which is funny. There was five 2 years ago, but now there's four. One's retired.
How did you learn your craft then? How did that... So you've found yourself in the model room. Where the hell do you start?
It is literally, you know, I mean, it isn't a... You know, it really is a bit of a dark art, model making. It's a build up of knowledge. It really is. You know, it's not something you can go, right, I'm going to do this in 2 years, and because it's impossible. It's a build up of knowledge. So really, by the other two model makers was really just showing me ways of doing things and teaching me. But yeah, when you get a trainee in, you learn pretty quickly whether they're going to be capable of doing it. And it's not so much the knowledge of lengths and fittings and whips and things like that. That you can learn. You can learn over time. It's the shape. So it's the lines. It's the curves. It's the balance. And you, I think within a couple of months, you'll know whether someone's going to be a model maker or not.
How do you start in terms of measurement? Do you go from someone's foot? How does it work? What's the process?
So for bespoke, you'd go from a foot draft. Yeah, you go for or obviously you can go from data now. You can scan a foot, but most of the time, the nature of bespoke is a service. It's something you're sort of aspiring to have a bespoke suit made or have a pair of bespoke shoes made. And I think it's a better thing to be measured up, whether it's a suit, whether it's a shoes. So we do foot drafts. So we literally get on hands and knees, we measure around feet, we take impressions of them, we talk to the customer, you know, how they like to wear their shoes, obviously what style of shoe they want the last to be, really. So it's for bespoke. So bespoke, yeah, you're starting with the feet. With manufactured lasts or lasts that go into factories, completely different process. The designers come in, or developers, can be a developer, they come in, or we do it. By, you know, we've been doing obviously a lot of Zoom calls and things lately. Mm-hmm. or they just send in packages of bits of drawings and soles and shoes, and it's completely different. Yeah, you're starting from the shoe designer's spec, vision. Really. So yeah, and it's working with the shoe designer or the shoe developer to start creating a last.
That must be more difficult.
It's I honestly think that, you know, it's obviously bespoke is considered the very top, the very pinnacle. But I actually think factory made lasts are a lot more accurate. They have to be a lot more accurate. You know, some of the direct molded stuff, etc. You can, if you're fractions of a mil out, you start getting the sole starts spewing out off the upper and things like that. So actually, definitely stuff you do for high street bulk manufacturer, the modelling has to be a lot.
Because you're making thousands rather than just.
Yeah, I think it's just.
Pairs.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, I think with bespoke, you're sort of obviously you're trying to achieve a fit and a look. You know, with bespoke, obviously orthopedic, you're just trying to achieve a fit, but with bespoke, you're trying to, and you are with manufacturer, but it's more accurate. It's more accurate. You just can't be fractions out. It's got to be 100%.
So tell me about this yacht to France.
Okay, right. Yeah. So going back to the youth training scheme.
Right. How did you go on a yacht to France for your youth training scheme?
Yeah. Okay. So that was one of the reasons I literally had to pick something quick. So because I was doing the welding, the TIG welding. And I walked out of that, and he said, "Well, you can't." And part of it was, of the youth training scheme, was to go on a trip. It was, you know, it's a 2-year training scheme, but part of it, you could go on a trip. And I chose to go on this 9-man yacht to France, which is great, fantastic. It was a great experience.
Of the youth. Was that part of Springline or just part of youth?
No, it's part of good old Margaret Thatcher.
That doesn't happen anymore, does it?
I was saying Margaret Thatcher's child. it doesn't. No, probably not. No.
But how amazing.
Yeah, it was brilliant. Honestly, it was fantastic.
And what an experience. So
never forgot it.
Yacht to France as part of your youth training scheme.
Yeah, and it was an old wooden yacht. I even remember the name. Duet, it was called, if anyone's out there on
She's
Duet.
Probably still out there somewhere.
I'm sure it was.
Where did you leave from?
Lowestoft. So we went round the East Coast and down into Calais. Yeah, which is great. So I think it was 3 or 4 days, two or three nights. So, and it was really good. But it was literally why I had to pick something quick because this yacht, if I didn't, I wouldn't have gotten this yacht.
It blows
my
mind.
It was literally, I need, that'll do. I'm good with my hands. I'll have a little go at that. So
what is the most satisfying part of last making process?
Definitely model making, getting to a point in your career when you can make pretty much anything a customer wants, you know, whether it's a Wellington boot last or whether it's, and then putting your own handwriting into it. You start, you know, every model maker's got their own handwriting. So at Springline, if the model making wasn't to the standard it was, we'd have far less customers. And you do get your own handwriting. You know, I can stand it. I know what I've done, obviously, but I can see which each of those model makers have done.
So what is your handwriting? How do we
My
know?
My handwriting is to try and make something look sexy, even, so we do some stuff so it's sort of like semi-orthopedic stuff. So they're manufactured, but they're for the hospitals. So they put the big, thick socks in to build up or take down the fittings in the shoe. But even that, you've got to try and give it something. So it's shaping, it's putting.
I love that.
It's hard without having something in front of you, the tools and things. I could show you. I should have brought a last along because we're being filmed, but I could show you what I mean. There's a way of making it look better than it need be, really.
And does that skill come with time, or are you able to teach that? What's the?
I always look back at vintage lasts. I've got for my poor wife. It's my cellar's full of shoe memorabilia. At a sort of a music stroke shoe room, if you like. My cellar's full of. My loft is full of shoe memorabilia. But I've got loads of old lasts kicking around in baskets and in fireplaces and things like that. I would go back to that because the standards then were far, far higher than what they are now. a lot of things in the sort of 60s, 70s were simplified. So they, you know, they were putting, whereas Lush would be more foot shaped, they were simplifying it by putting the instep or the cone down the middle mm-hmm. of the last and losing all the character out of them. So I always go back to old vintage.
I do love the wooden ones.
Yeah,
I think
it's so tactile.
They're just beautiful. So what is the secret to Springline being England's only surviving shoe last maker?
Okay, so when I started, the trade was in massive decline, UK trade at the time. So our competitors were a company called Bobs Miller in Kettering, and they were coming from a different direction. We were tiny. They were huge. They were the biggest in the world. Probably during the 60s into the 70s, they were the biggest in the world, I'd say. They got their own forests in Canada where they got their wood from. They were one of the first to develop the plastic for bulk manufactured last. They got factories in Taiwan, where obviously the Far East first started importing from, and they were huge. So their business really was to get those big factories that were producing 30,000-40,000 pairs of shoes a week. They wanted that business because it was big pair of gelas. Whereas we were coming from completely the other angle, you know, which was so exciting as you got into it. It was so exciting because as I 83, so coming up into late 80s, 90s, really, you know, companies like which, you know, I know you were part of Red or Dead, yeah. Shelley's, all those guys, you know, and many more. There were so many more. Look, I saw Nicky Lawler the other day, yeah. Lawler Duffy, you know, brands like that. It was so exciting because it was raw. It was. But they were doing so, it was so different. It was just...
It was a very new era, wasn't it?
It was a new era, yeah. But Mobs Miller weren't interested in that. You know, that was perhaps 36 pairs over a size range at last.
Yeah.
They didn't want that. They needed hundreds. So we were sort of supplying customers like that. But obviously by doing that, you know what's going on fashion wise. You know, you're learning all the time. You're starting to follow the fashions. That's part of being a model maker as well. You've got to follow what's going on. You know, if you lose track of what's going on, you're not really giving your customer the best of what they should have, really.
So do you have really close relationships with a lot of factories? And are they predominantly in the UK or are they international? How does that work?
Okay, so last wise, it's UK, yeah. So we're very close with obviously all the Northamptonshire factories. We supply them all from the light. Am I allowed to reel off names?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So the likes of, you know, Trickers, Crockett and Jones, Church's, Jeffrey West, Dr. Martin. We supply them all. You know, we supply them all. Yeah. So we're very close to all the designers, developers, of those brands. So we do a development service as well, where we just do the development really, but then it goes off seas, but they're coming to us for our knowledge of creating a good last. So like I've done it, brands of, you know, the likes of Lacoste, Kickers, Paul Smith's, Ted Baker's,
yeah.
Oliver Sweeney's, Vivienne Westwood, you know, all that sort of. So we do a development service. We do shoe trees as well, which are the trees that go inside the,
yeah,
posh pair of shoes. You know, if you've got a nice pair of shoes that retain the shape of your shoes. So we do a lot of that, but that's more overseas. That's more, you know, America, Japan, Europe. Yeah, all over the world, really. That is, it is such an
interesting job.
I do. I've got to say, sometimes you can look. Because I still keep a written diary.
Every day, just in the office, what happens?
Just what I've got on, really. More what I've got on, not so much what's happened. But I do keep a written diary rather than the phone one.
Yeah.
And I feel you can look back at it. I'm quite blessed, really, because you know, in one day you can go and see a customer at John Lobb.
Yeah.
You know, you can look down at Edward Green. You know, these amazing brands, amazing companies, really. You know. Trickers, 195 years old, and I'm there sort of developing their latest. It is.
But I think that's when you really are a true craftsman. Do you participate in any other crafts, or do you stick to, you could probably do anything with wood, can't you now?
I think, I make things. do make things when I get time. The last thing I made probably was a bird table, but it looks like a chapel. So it's
does got, it? Of course so it's it does. Got,
so it's got the cross. I've made the cross and I tiled the roof and it's got a bell on it. You know, so it looks like a chapel. I'll send you a picture.
Yeah, I'd like to see that.
I just repaired because all the tiles fell off. So
that would be really good to see it. Yeah, you might have to repair it.
Yeah, things like that. I'd love to have a go at pottery. I really would. I've got to try and find time to do that.
You've got to lock that in.
It's all about shape.
Because I reckon you'd be amazing at that too.
Yeah, you've got to keep. It's all about shape.
Who would have thought that from your youth training scheme and your preamble on a boat that you would be a master craftsman?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I'm not sure I've been called a master craftsman.
Well,
before,
I think you are. So tell me a little bit about the more extreme lasts you make for clowns and Harry Potter goblins. What's all that about?
Yeah. Okay. So we do. There's companies in London that make for theatre and film. Only small companies, but they do quite a lot. Yeah, the goblins one. So that was a company called K&D Shoes at the time. They had to make the shoes for all the goblins in Harry Potter film. So yeah, we had to do the loss. That's simple as that. So that for instance, we had to do in two parts. We had to put the toe and do them out of wood, and we had to stick the toe on there because they were so long. But we've done we've done Hagrid's as well, which I've not actually posted up, but done stuff recently for Hagrid. In theatre as well, which is amazing.
What is the most extreme or unusual loss that you've done?
I suppose the most extreme we've done, so starting at a size 22 shackle, and Neil is quite a, you know, he's a big guy.
I think I've got that one.
Have you got, yeah, this was it for
Might
Ted?
Have been, yes.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
I've
yeah,
got
yeah.
it in my office.
Have you? Yeah, okay, yeah, that's
nice. Nuts.
So again, we had to do it in two parts. The biggest was a 28, which was for Dr. Martens, and they actually put the soles down for this guy. So he's the tallest guy in the world, and they'd done it as a PR type thing, and they put the Dr. Martens sole down, 28. The last are in Dr. Martens museum, but I've got a pair of the soles. That was huge.
I'm blown away that, I mean, I knew it was for Shaquille O'Neal, but I didn't know that you had done that.
Yeah, no, that was us. Yeah.
That is incredible.
Loads of things really. Like you said, clowns. We've done clown shoes or last for shoes, all sorts of things.
So, do you still offer youth training schemes or the equivalent today?
We don't. I think as a small business, you obviously get very wrapped up in your day to day of what you do, and trying to satisfy your customers' needs. We really should look into it because I think there are schemes out there. We need to try and look into it. The latest two we've employed in the model room anyway, we've just self-trained. So again, similar to what I did. But we should look into it.
I love a bit of give back.
Yeah.
I like it when you learn and return, you know, and that you give back to...
Totally, yeah. I mean, I really, you know, I'm 55 now, so I've not got that long, really, if you think what I say.
Hopefully you've got another 40 years.
If it takes 5 years to get someone to working to a standard of working with customers, I've got to act soon. And I really, you know, if I don't train up 3 or 4 more model makers before I finish.
You need to get moving on that one.
Devastated, really, because you've got to hand it on. You know, you've got to hand it on. There's a great knowledge in this country, not just of glass, but of shoemaking.
So I think it's now down on video and on sound.
It's going to happen.
It's
going to happen, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So what does a normal day look like in your life now?
So a normal day, I get in early. I was in... 6:45 this morning, which is probably the first hour is the time when you get everything in. You know, I write lists. I write lists. Yeah, lists are good. You cross something off, you feel better.
Yeah.
So I write lists. But no, so I go in. I either sort of saunter around the factory, check where everything is, see what we've got to get out for that day. Talk to the guys down there, and we have two girls working in the factory as well.
Fantastic.
They're brilliant. Yeah, fantastic.
And out of the ratio of
so
How many have you got who are, how many females, what is it, not many, or is it
No, it's not many. So there's probably 22 and two are ladies, well, one lady in the office as well.
So we need to get that one up as well.
Yeah, probably, yeah. Yeah, why not? Honestly, I'm so pleased. They're really good.
Yeah.
You know, they're eye for detail. Again, even in the factory, you need an eye for detail on what you're doing, because if you get it wrong, you're back to the start. You have to, you know, you really are. It goes in the bin and you start again.
It does sound like an incredible job, though.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, so that was, and carrying on with my day, you're then obviously trying to model make, talking to customers, emails. Oh, that's all sorts.
You still do your model making now?
I'm still model making, yeah. Yeah.
And do you go round and check everyone else's work?
They tend to come to me, yeah. Yeah, not all of it, because there's a guy called John who's senior or older than me.
Yeah.
So he's fine, you know. But yeah, the two younger ones I tend to oversee still, which is fine. But they've got it, really. It's just, I think, just for them, really. They just ask questions, which is good.
It's
so
amazing.
It's a build up of knowledge. It's so model making, emails, customers, possibly going out to see customers coming in. Yeah, and then probably doing more emails at night that I haven't done in the day, which
because you're trying to model make.
Yeah, yeah. Instagram. I do the Instagram thing as well.
Oh, do you?
Just on my phone, which is, it's not.
But it's why you, I think the thing about Instagram is to do it while you're on the go and doing stuff that you do.
Yeah.
Because it's authentic.
Yeah, it's all, yeah. It's funny what people like on Instagram, isn't it? I put up something that I think is really interesting.
What was it?
It can be, you know, perhaps a, because I sort of try and sell Northampton a bit, which desperately needs selling.
Yeah.
So I put up maybe a picture of an old factory. And it's all right. You know, so people, but then you put up, I don't know, like a picture of filing a little bit of a last. And it gets like loads of like, it's really weird.
I reckon you need to get on TikTok with that last making.
Do you? Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, you'd have to tell me all about that. I'm not. So that's the other thing about being a craftsperson. You know, it's technology's alien. So I'm always behind with the technology side of it.
I definitely feel like you would be a big hit on TikTok with your lasts. So what's the best bit of advice you've had?
Okay, surround yourself with positive, creative people, I think, and steer away from negative. It's got to be, isn't it?
Who gave you that advice?
I'm going to get in trouble. So when I started, there was two partners. One was great fun, creative, enjoyed it, the whole thing, you know, just enjoyed life. One wasn't quite that way, or isn't quite that way. Yeah, so it's just, it come about then, really. And it's good advice. It's good advice, you know, because it's so easy to get wrapped up in the day-to-day and end up, you know, tearing your hair up, being miserable.
And not enjoying them now.
Not being happy. It's, yeah, so you just, life's for living, isn't it? You just got to get on with it, really. And
so what would you say to anyone who wanted to get into last-making?
You'll make a living, but you won't be wealthy. But the rewards are fantastic. You know, it's considered a gentle craft, isn't it? Shoemaking, I think it's called gentle craft. And the people you meet, yeah, it's amazing. You know, not just from the designers, some of the amazing designers you meet, but also the opportunity to measure up feet that you'd never, you know, people you never thought you'd meet.
So on that, what are the most famous feet you've ever measured?
So I think the proudest moment was Prince Charles. You know, it's got to be. You know, it was through Trickers. So they were very kind to invite me because he'd come up for their 190th year, visited the factory. And they very kindly invited me to do a little sort of display of last and talk to him. So I did that. And then from that, we went to measure him up at Clarence House and they made his last, made his shoes. So, and, you know, and he wrote a letter, which was really, really nice. So I was really, really proud of that.
And in terms of any celebrities?
Yeah, lots of sports, lots of celebs. We're sort of in the process. It actually was meant to be done the first year of COVID, so September, October, of doing a exhibition in the Northampton Museum. So I measured up about 13 Northampton celeb sort of people that are famous, that type of thing. So, yeah, we've done, I don't know, Alan Carr, Reverend Coles, Charles Spencer, who's Diane's brother, people like that. So we've got that to come. I won't read them all off because that's to come. No. We've still got to get that in the museum.
That's
and get
really
it displayed.
Exciting.
So we've got their foot drafts, we've got their lasts, and all the Northamptonshire factories, they all made, so Churchage made shoes for Dylan Hartley and Tricker's made shoes for Reverend Coles. So we've got all the factories involved as well.
That's really cool.
The coolest guy I've ever met. Doing it, oh, it's got to be Idris Elba.
Oh, have you done his feet?
Yeah. He come to the factory as well.
Did he?
Yeah. What a guy. Just, you know, some people just light up the whole place.
Yeah.
He did. He went, honestly, everybody, he spoke to everybody. Everybody was buzzing after he'd been.
Good energy.
Yeah, really good, yeah, yeah.
So how do you go about positive business in your company?
I think that's a question, isn't it? Positive business. Do you mean in how do I we make it feel it, good? Or
I suppose it's a thing about sustainability and about how people work and just, I suppose, keeping that good energy and culture going.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're sort of considered a high standard of what we do. So there's a positivity around that. Recycling, we recycle all the plastic that comes off the machines that goes back in to make more plastic glass. We know we could improve, in all honesty, Katie. We're not the most, you know, just even things like our, you know, we've still got a diesel van. We should have an electric van. But it has been quite, you know, saying that, we've been plateaued for about 4 years now. Yeah. I think mainly because of COVID, really.
Yeah.
You know, it knocked it. We had various plans and it completely, because no one ordered, who's going to order bolt last?
I think that everyone's on their journey, and I think it's now just marking out what your new journey is going to be and how you go about it and what you could do to just make them, I suppose, minor things that actually make a major impact.
Yeah, definitely. No, I totally agree. You know, really, we've got, you know, obviously we've got sawdust and pieces of wood. Something else we're thinking about is getting a pelletizer, so you can pelletize all that up and heat the factory on it rather than at the minute it's oil.
Well, that might be a good idea anyway at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. Get some solar panels on the roof or something. You know, it's difficult as a small company though. You know, you just more time than anything.
Yeah.
To
get round to it.
Yeah, you get involved in so many little bits and bobs. But we do need to do it. And bring me back in 3 years, and if I haven't done anything, shout at me.
So you're now working with your son, I believe.
Yeah, Sonny has been there. He's my oldest son. He's been there. I think he started about 10 years ago. Then he went to Edward Green to do pattern cutting and then came back. So, yeah, he's already in it. I think he's 28. So he's, again, similar. He's been in it 10 years already. And, really pleased. He's got it. You know, he's a good model maker already.
And how is it working with your son?
It's good, thank goodness. He's placid. he doesn't tell me off very often, but it's good. Yeah.
That's so. Could you call it a family business soon?
It's again. Springline is going through. I think we're going through a change pretty soon because the senior shareholder is 75, and I think he's finally wants to. So it could be pretty soon. Possibly. I count my chickens. But,
so what excites you about the future?
Future, I think there's so much. I really think there's a, you know, I'm not a Brexiteer by a long shot, but I actually think it's evened things up in that people, there's more people looking to make things in the UK again, you know, produce things in the UK. So there's, you know, I think even the last 2 years we've had, there's lots of little cottagey type, you know, whether it's slippers or ladies' pumps and things like that. Loads of people are trying to make a brand, make their own little brands, which is fantastic to see. You know, it's
I definitely think it's people are making more locally because there's so many problems with distribution, getting stuff back in the country, and all the energy bills and travel bills and cost of shipping.
I think the love of craft as well. I think people have realised that things haven't got to be produced like sausages. I mean, I really tried my hardest during the first COVID year. I didn't use Amazon. I was buying, you know, Welsh-made jeans. I was everything. I was trying to because I was like, I've got to try and support it somewhere. If I don't, you know, I think there's a feel for it. You know, I think it almost started before COVID. Really, that things could come back to the UK a bit more. I don't think it'll ever be producing the tens, 20s, 40,000 pairs a week type thing. But I think it, you know, handmade things made with a bit of love, I think is good.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Have you got any future ambitions? Is it something that you want to do next?
Teach.
You want to teach?
Yeah, teach.
That would be amazing.
Teach what I know, really. You know, just say it's such an accumulation of knowledge. And unfortunately, a lot of it's not written down. So it's literally spending time with younger people and telling them what you know. If they're interested in doing it.
And do the footwear institutions know that you want to teach? Or have you just kept this to yourself?
I spoke to certainly the Cordwainers. You know, coming away from the awards the other day, you know, I sort of feel like I want to get involved with Northamptonshire Uni a bit more.
So it was the Cordwainers Footwear Awards.
Sorry.
That's all right. It was the Cordwainers Footwear Awards last Thursday, and which was June 22. And Michael was there. And it was phenomenal because there's so many young designers. And I think so many footwear designers, they don't even know that there is a thing that there's courses that you can go on to be a footwear designer. So to have so many from Northampton, London College of Fashion and De Montfort in the room is by the very fact that there's so many young footwear, incredible talent in one room is amazing. So then to have Michael with his last making craftsman skills is also pretty out there, isn't it?
It was, as you say, there's some, you know, looking at some of those portfolios in the foyer bit downstairs and the shoes, some of the shoes that are made, you know, it's brilliant, isn't it? There's some real talent out there and it's just nurturing them really, getting them started, getting them, just getting involved in that a little bit more really. So definitely.
Well, I think that is just such a lovely way to end this part before we move on to the quick fire questions. Are you ready for this?
Yeah, go on then.
Trainers or formal shoes?
Northampton Goodyear World.
Fashion trend you just don't get?
Oh, socks and sliders. Gotta be, isn't it? What is that all about?
Favourite food?
Today would be sushi because it's so hot.
It's a good sushi day, isn't it?
It is a good sushi day.
What's the scariest, bravest thing you've ever done?
When I was younger, I went on this adventure thing. Sorry, this isn't very quick. Went on an adventure thing and I had to swim through a cavern of a cave that was flooded without a lamp. I was the only one without...
Dark.
I was the only one without a light on my helmet as well.
Doesn't sound great to me.
No, I didn't like that.
That sounds...
It's twitchy.
Yeah, I feel twitchy about you talking about it. What's your karaoke song? I bet you're good at karaoke.
I have never done... I've only got water, so... I'd have to get really drunk to do karaoke. I would go My Generation by The Who.
Yeah, I think you'd be good at that.
Thank you. I'm not sure.
Favourite cocktail?
Bloody Mary.
Nice. Would you rather have an extra arm or an extra eye?
I'm so busy at the moment. Arm. Filing with three arms.
What's your favourite read?
I think biographies. So things like Ollie Reed was good and Ozzy Osbourne, stuff like that. People that are just completely potty.
Yeah, good biographies. Only jeans or only a suit for the rest of your life?
Suit.
Whoa.
Although it would be difficult today.
That'd be good with your trainers. Oh no, you weren't trainers, were you? Welted. No, that would welted, yeah, I get it. What's your guilty pleasure?
Joanna Lumley.
Yeah, don't blame me. She's good.
Yeah, I can get away with that as well because my wife loves her as well.
So. Yeah. She I love
come,
her too.
Joanne, if you're listening, please come and you're welcome to come and live with us.
Tidy or messy?
Tidy, totally.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd organise clutter.
Do you enjoy building flat pack furniture?
Oh, what a question to ask me.
I know.
No. Oh, I hate it. I don't really like it.
I bet you're good at it though. But you just get annoyed with it, probably.
No,
you're a craftsman, you can't deal with it. Especially when there's a part missing.
Yeah. When you IKEA, yeah. When you come back with the wrong bits or the wrong part.
When are you most productive?
Morning.
Would you rather swim to work or cycle to work?
Cycle. Swimming, I'd never get there, I think.
Sun or activity holiday?
Activity.
Do you think you would make a good Prime Minister?
Yeah, I think I probably would. Yeah, I'm not sure why, but I think I probably would. Common sense.
Common sense and calmness.
Yeah.
That's all you need, isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
For more information on Springline, where should our listeners go?
Either to Springline Last, which is the Instagram, Facebook, or obviously the website, springline last.net. I'm not actually sure it is, but our website, you'll find it. It's the first one that comes up.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's been an absolute pleasure to walk in your shoes. For more interest in Cordwainers livery, please visit our website, cordwainers.org, or our Instagram, Worshipful Cordwainers. Way!
Thank you very much. It's great. Another one ticked off.
Tick!